Welcome to Whiskey Cask, Cask Strength Conversation, featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 320 for June 12th, 2011. Coming up in a few minutes...
We've been quite a shy distillery in the past.
That's John McDonald, the manager of Balblair Distillery in the Scottish Highlands. John and I have talked many times over the years, but this was the first time I was on his home turf in the tiny town of Edderton, where there are more cows than people, and a Pictish standing stone from the Bronze Age oversees the distillery. More with John in a few minutes, along with the calendar of events, the emails of the week, and the What I'm Tasting This Week department. First, though, let's look at the news. It's brought to you by Glenmorangie. We have a lot of new releases to talk about this week. Compass Box is launching a new range of blended Scotch whiskies under the Great King Street label. The first expression in the range launched this week in Europe, and the artist's blend will reach the U.S. and other global markets starting in September. Now, Compass Box does things differently, and this is certainly no exception. At least in Europe, the blends will be sold in 50 cl bottles and will use French oak barrels to marry whiskies from selected casks. By the way, Great King Street refers to the address for Compass Box's office in Edinburgh, which is located on Great King Street. Compass Box's John Glazer cut his teeth in the whiskey business at Johnny Walker, and what is clearly the most expensive Johnny Walker expression on record is being planned to celebrate Queen Elizabeth's 60th year on the throne in 2012. The John Walker & Sons Diamond Jubilee is made exclusively from whiskies distilled back in 1952, and 60 decanters will be filled on February 6th, the anniversary of Queen Elizabeth's coronation. The price? 100,000 pounds each, or around $162,000. Diageo plans to donate all of the profits from the expression to the Queen's Scholarship Trust, with a guaranteed donation of at least 1 million pounds. By the way, if you have to ask where to buy one... Don't plan on getting a decanter. The sales will be by invitation only. Back to the mere mortal level now, but let's keep the charity theme going. Buffalo Trace is about to release its Millennium Edition bourbon. The cask was the final one filled on New Year's Eve 1999 and produced 174 bottles of bourbon. Here's the catch. Buffalo Trace will be giving all 174 bottles to charities to auction off, with a goal of raising $200,000 for charity. If you're affiliated with a U.S.-based nonprofit and have the IRS tax number to prove it, you can apply online to receive one of the bottles, as long as you hold the auction by the end of this year. I've posted a link to the Millennium Barrel site at the WhiskeyCast website. Meanwhile, Wild Turkey is releasing a new bourbon with a twist. It's the first one created by Eddie Russell, the distillery's associate master distiller, and son of master distiller Jimmy Russell. Wild Turkey 81 is bottled at 81 proof, or 40.5% ABV. Eddie designed it to stand up in cocktails, and as he puts it, not disappear like a fox down a hole when mixed with colas. By the way, I'll be at the distillery later on this month, and I'll have more comments from Eddie on an upcoming episode. But the Whiskey Fairy has already delivered a sample. I'll have tasting notes later in this episode. Three new expressions from Benromic, a cask strength bottling matured in first-filled bourbon barrels, bottled at 59.9% ABV, a 30-year-old Benromic bottled at 43%, and the Benromic Wood Finish Hermitage with a mix of malts from ex-sherry and bourbon casks, finished for 22 months in wine casks from France's Hermitage appellation in the Rhone region. There's also a new vintage release from the Glenrothes. The 1995 was the first vintage laid down specifically for bottling as a single malt and has a mix of first-fill American and Spanish oak sherry casks along with refill sherry casks. It's bottled at 43% ABV. Now, for the last couple of years, Glendronic's Belgian distributor has been taking a single cask on the road each June in the back of a van. This year's road trip starts on June 20th in Campenhout and will wind up in Wareham on the 25th. The cask is a 2002 bottling at 55% ABV, matured in a Pedro Jimenez sherry butt, and customers will be able to actually fill a bottle from that cask at tour stops along the way. I've posted the tour stops in the calendar of events on the WhiskeyCast website. In other news, I reported back in April that Glenglassaugh Distillery Manager Graham Yunson is leaving to move over to Tomaten Distillery. He's being replaced by two people. Mary McDonald will become production manager in charge of everything up to the spirit safe. She's currently training at the distillery now. Graham Morrison will become maturation manager in charge of cask filling operations and warehouse management. Graham has been with the distillery since it reopened. And finally, there's a boycott brewing against Scotch whiskey in Israel and the U.S., or at least whiskeys from a specific region of Scotland. The Jerusalem Post reports Sunday that the U.S.-based Federation of Jewish Men's Clubs and its 25,000 members are joining with synagogues in Israel to protest a boycott of Israeli products in West Dunbartonshire. Local council members there voted to stop purchasing Israeli-made products in order to support Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. That sparked a counter-protest targeting Scotch whiskey, and the activists are targeting Shivas Brothers, Morrison Beaumont, and Loch Lomond, which all have facilities in West Dunbartonshire. The Israeli blogger leading the boycott wants the distillers to put pressure on their local politicians to withdraw that ban. Morrison Beaumont's Kirstine Beeston told the Jerusalem Post that the company doesn't take any political positions and had no role in the local council's decision. The company is forwarding protest emails to council members. And that's the news. It's brought to you by Glenmorangie, unnecessarily well-made. Let's look at the inbox now. The emails of the week are brought to you this time around by Johnny Walker. As I mentioned earlier, I was at Balblair this week, along with the other Inverhouse distilleries, as part of an international beverages media trip. I mentioned this on Facebook during the week and posted a photo from my mystery hotel room in Elgin. Had a bunch of guesses, but Ronnie Rutledge of Glenglassauk was the only one to guess correctly. He picked the Mansion House Hotel. Meanwhile, Adrian Bones asked, "Why don't you just come to Scotland to live and broadcast back home?" It's an interesting idea, but I can't qualify for a UK work visa. Two questions on travel retail this week. Mike Morin posted on the WhiskeyCast Facebook page. A friend is traveling through Heathrow next week and wants to buy a $300 bottle of whiskey for a special dinner for eight. Any recommendations? And following up on that, Corianne Strakosch posted, "My wife is off in the States in a few weeks, and I'm after a list of travel retail whiskeys that she could pick up for me. Any ideas?" Well, first off, let's answer Mike's question. I'm going to need some help from the rest of you on it, since I've only gone through Heathrow once or twice, and I haven't yet been able to get to the new high-end World of Whiskies shop in Terminal 5. If you have some ideas, please add your comments at the WhiskeyCast Facebook page. Now for Corian. I hate to break it to you, but the U.S. airports don't take duty-free as seriously as they do in other regions. I've never seen anything really unusual in a U.S. airport yet, and the travel retail bourbons on hand are the same that you'd find in many export markets. Corian, it'd be better to have your wife look for a whiskey shop away from the airport and see what she can find for you there. If you have a question or a suggestion, you can always post your comments at the WhiskeyCast Facebook page or just email me. My email address is comments@whiskeycast.com. And the emails of the week are brought to you this time around by Johnny Walker on the web at johnnywalker.com, where you can become a whiskey insider today. Time now for the calendar of events brought to you by Laphroaig. Tickets are available starting this Monday for a special Suntory tasting with master blender Dr. Koichi Inotomi, June 20th at the Whiskey Exchange Vinopolis in London. There's no charge for the tasting, but a minimum donation of £50 is being requested, with all proceeds going to Japanese earthquake relief. As part of the evening, there'll be a raffle for a rare bottle of Hibiki 30-year-old, and Dr. Inotomi is bringing a couple of rare Suntory whiskies from his personal collection to be auctioned off that night. Other events coming up, the Whiskey Cafe L&B in Amsterdam will hold a special Father's Day tasting of Speyside single malts on the 19th. The Whiskey Classic Tasting Cruise is June 23rd in Washington, D.C. The San Diego Spirits Festival is on the 25th and 26th. The Tollbooth Tavern in Edinburgh has Jolly Topper tastings on June 23rd and July 7th. And Tales of the Cocktail runs from July 20th through the 24th in New Orleans. You'll find a full calendar of events at the WhiskeyCast website, and it's brought to you by Laphroaig. Become a friend of Laphroaig today and claim your own square foot of Isla. This week's WhiskeyCast In Depth is brought to you by Auchentoshan. I met Bal Blair manager John McDonald for the first time at Whiskey Live Paris in the fall of 2008. Since then, we've talked many times about me visiting him at the distillery one day. We finally pulled it off this week. Good thing, since John's summer is about to get far more hectic than things usually are in Edderton.
This year is possibly the busiest year that I've had since I've started here. Next week we have Ken Loach making a movie, which is called The Angel's Share. Anything more than that, I really can't tell you. We'll have to wait and see. Until next year, I think it's going to be released in summertime. That's really exciting for us, and it's fantastic exposure for Bal Blair.
How did they pick your distillery to be the site of the movie?
Well, it's an easy choice, Mark. You just come to the distillery, you see how beautiful it is, and hey, he was hooked.
And then after that, what happens?
They start shooting on Monday, a week today. They're going to use the number 3 warehouse and the old malting barns, which they've already transformed into a set. There's also a chance for a couple of the guys to be involved in the movie, including me. I just hope it's not a speaking part. I actually went for the part of man drinking heavily in the corner, but I didn't get it.
Well, you have no experience with that, right?
Not at all, Mike. Drink responsibly, yeah.
But after the movie guys wrap their production here, then the fun really starts, right?
Indeed, yeah. In July, we're going to have the second wedding, Bal Blair. It's with Tracy and Dan. Tracy's father used to work here for many, many years. So that's really a nice thing to have here. And the visitor centre construction begins 2 days after the wedding. So hopefully by, I would say, certain beginning of October, we should have everything in place then, which will give visitors, you know, a more enhanced experience of Bal Blair.
And until now, it's really only been open by appointment or if just somebody drops by, but now you're actually going to be able to accommodate tours and really make this a visitor spot, right?
Indeed. We've been quite a shy distillery in the past. Myself and Graham would accommodate visitors, you know, if they just turned up on the doorstep. But it's all dependent on time and what you're doing. But I just found in the last couple of years, especially since we've done the vintage releases, that more and more people were wanting to visit the distillery. And it was becoming too much for myself and Graham to actually handle the amount of visitors. And that's why we employed Julie to become our tour guide. And I have to say that she's doing a fantastic job so far. I've been sneakily asking visitors that she's taken round after the tour, how was your tour? And it's been very, very positive.
And she has some experience because her husband is one of the 7 guys that works in the production operations, right?
It is. She has an advantage there. She knows the plant very well already by taking John down his dinner on the back shift and even the day shift. And Julie really appreciates what a fine distillery we've got here. I mean, the location is absolutely beautiful. And I think as you come down that road, it's just what you'd expect a distillery to look like if you hadn't visited one before.
And we will have photos of the distillery up on the website along with a WhiskeyCast HD episode from Bal Blair soon. But you mentioned the vintage releases. The last one that came out was the 2000 last fall, but you've got another one coming out in 2 different variations on the 1995, right?
The 1995 has been released in Sweden and also in Asia as duty-free. Again, it's very, very high quality. It's been actually quite a while since I nosed it myself. That was actually done last year. I'm sure it'll do very, very well. And it sits really nicely alongside the other vintages. You know, it's kind of natural progression. The 2000, there will be another release of 2000 shortly. But we're already looking ahead for next vintage, but I can't tell you what it is. You'll have to wait and see.
How successful have the vintages been, and how much stock are you able to put aside for those vintages for the future? Because I know you have, what, about 25,000 casks here on site. How much are you able to put aside for vintages?
We're obviously a very small distillery, but our emphasis is on quality, and it's not quantity. Hence, the vintage releases have all been very small bottlings. For instance, when the first appeared, 97, 89, and 79, that was only 81 casks for that entire bottling. But that's the way we want to move forward. The emphasis is on quality, not quantity. So we have, put it this way, there's no shortage of very, very good whiskey inside those warehouses. But quantity-wise, well, as you know, the vintages tell us when it's ready. There's no way I'm going to put my name on the box of a vintage that isn't, you know, the highest quality that we can get.
Let me phrase it another way. We're in 2011 right now, so I assume that at some point you're laying down some stock that you envision could be a 2011 vintage someday, or will you wait till you see how this year's vintage ages before you decide whether it goes as a vintage or not, right?
Well, there's now a very strict wood policy implemented, you know, not just at Ball Blair, but all Denver House sites. You know, if you could go back maybe 20, 30 years and you kind of had a mixed bag of quality of casks. I'm sure that's true of most other distilleries as well. But now with a very strict wood policy and, you know, a consistency of spirit coming through the stills, you know, I don't think there's anything to worry about for future releases.
You're one of the few distilleries that really doesn't do the age statements anymore, that does the vintage releases. And we keep hearing comments throughout from other people within the industry, but also from connoisseurs that, well, age statements are what matter, and if the whiskey's not old enough, then it's not going to be good enough. What went into the decision to switch over from age statements a few years ago to doing vintage releases?
It was a change of direction. I mean, when the vintages were, you know, prior to release, the packaging and bottling was redone, and it was really to emphasise quality that Ball Blair whiskey is. So the decision to go vintage, you know, was quite an easy one to make. That allows us to pick the very, very best casks from that year. Like I said, you know, we don't rely on a cask birthday, say July the 8th, 1999. I will examine the stock, and the lab, you know, Stuart Harvey, the master blender especially, will examine the stock. And if that whiskey is good enough, it's good enough. You know, I've tasted whiskies that have been like 5, 6 years old, which have been very, very good. And I've tasted whiskies that have been 21, 23, 24, that I thought, you know, didn't really cut it. So for me personally, I would say age isn't everything.
Since it's been a couple of years since we've really talked about the history here, I think the last time we did this was in 2008 when you and I met in Paris at Whiskey Live Paris. For those who have not gone back into the archives, Ball Blair has been around since 1790. Sort of run through the history here for me, if you can.
Well, the distillery itself was established 1790, and that makes us one of the oldest working distilleries in Scotland, and it's the oldest in the Highlands. It was established by a local man, a local farmer called John Ross, very unusual name for Rossshire. And it was run by generations of the Ross family until 1893. The first location for Ball Blair Distillery was at Ball Blair Farm, which is about half a mile away from here. It was then purchased by a wine merchant from Inverness called Alexander Cowan, and he moved it down to this location and recommenced production in 1894. Unfortunately, he was declared bankrupt in 1911. So between 1911 and 1948, there's zero happening at Ball Blair. By 1932, all stock had been sold, so it really was, you know, an empty ship. And it wasn't until 1948 that a solicitor from Banff near Aberdeen called Robert Cummings bought the distillery. and he really revitalised it, and production recommenced in 1949. In 1970, Mr. Cummings was obviously becoming quite elderly, and nobody really to follow in his footsteps. So he then sold the distillery to Hiram Walker, who then became Ally Distillers. They in turn then sold Ballinblair to Inverhouse Distillers in 1996. And then in 2001, Inverhouse Distillers was purchased by what's now our parent company in Thailand, what was then Pacific Spirits, which now goes under the title of International Beverages.
How's the spirit changed over the years? Or how far back have you been able to taste whiskey from here to see if it's changed?
I'm lucky enough to have in my possession here New Make Spirit from 1960, which was given to me by the daughter of Robert Cummings, who just appeared outside one day. She just wanted a picture taken with her grandson. So I introduced myself, and she introduced herself. Okay, Cummings, any relation? And then she said, oh, yeah, well, I'm actually his daughter. So 5 hours later, she says, look, I have to leave. It wasn't a question of me telling her to leave, but just we got on very, very well. And she's since visited the distillery on two occasions, and she gave me New Make that she had in her barn. She has a farm in the Borders, and that was from 1960. And it is very different to the New Make spirit that we produce now. If you go back to those days in 1960, the distillery still had floor maltings. The peat levels, I'm unsure of, there's no real records to go on there, but it would have been a cast iron mash tun. It would have been smaller stills with worm tubs. So it is a very, very different New Make spirit.
And the fact that you had the floor maltings here, were that part of the reason the distillery was moved to be right next to the railroad track so you could get shipments of coal and barley, right?
Yeah, absolutely right. Yeah, it made perfect sense to move it down to what is the main line, which is about 3 meters away from my office.
And you guys have to hope that none of those trains ever derail, because it could take out the entire distillery if one ever did, right?
Yeah, I've already done a risk assessment for train derailment, yeah.
How much fun is it to work at a place like this that really is probably 30 to 40 miles away from any, from the nearest major city is Inverness, and that's maybe 30 to 40 miles away. And when you're walking around here, the most noise you're likely to hear is the train coming through every 2 or 3 hours, or some of the cows in the nearby fields sounding off. How much fun is it to live out here with a family and work at a distillery like this?
For me, absolutely fantastic. When myself and my wife moved here, I mean, we just moved from Tain, and even from there, you know, this was very, very quiet. This suits me down to the ground. I mean, as you drive down that road and you see the location of the distillery and what you have around you, you know, it's absolutely beautiful. You know, why would I want to live anywhere else?
Full disclosure, I visited Bal Blair as a guest of Inverhouse and International Beverage as part of a media trip with bloggers from Sweden, Israel, and the UK. This week's Whiskey Cast In Depth is brought to you by Auchentoshan, the triple distilled since 1823, on the web at auchentoshan.com. Now, I've tasted almost all of Bal Blair's vintages in the past. You'll find my tasting notes at the Whiskey Cast website and in the smartphone apps. But there's a second release of the Bal Blair 1989 that I hadn't tasted until now. And let's start off the What I'm Tasting This Week department with a look at it. The second release of Bal Blair 1989 is bottled at 43% ABV. It is chill-filtered, but with no caramel coloring added. The nose is complex and spicy, with notes of allspice and hazelnut on top, a bit tart underneath with a slight lemony touch, and banana cream pie with graham cracker crust. The taste is spicy with a cinnamon blast that lingers with a touch of banana underneath, and the finish brings back the tartness of key lime pie with the banana touch remaining constant. I'm scoring the Bal Blair 1989 second release a 93. For the record, I scored the original 1989 release an 88 last year. The Whiskey Exchange will be releasing an 11-year-old Springbank soon as part of its Single Malts of Scotland series. It was distilled in 1999 and matured in a sherry cask before bottling at 53% ABV. Thanks to the Cowfish, Billy Abbott of the Whiskey Exchange, for giving me a sample this week during the trip. It's a rich coppery color. The nose is full of dried fruits, ginger, and touches of brandy, honey, and licorice. The taste starts off with pungent pipe tobacco and leather, very mouth-coating as the cinnamon kicks in, with a meaty steak-like note and a slight bitterness in the finish with a leathery touch. I'm scoring the Springbank 11-year-old from the Whiskey Exchange's Single Malts of Scotland series, an 83. As I mentioned earlier, Wild Turkey 81 is Eddie Russell's first bourbon in his own right. He's worked with his father Jimmy on the entire Wild Turkey and Russell's Reserve ranges in the past and crafted the 81 to work well in cocktails. It holds up well on its own, though. The nose has a good balance of vanilla, caramel, and oak notes. The taste is smooth and spicy with cinnamon on top and honey underneath, with a touch of vanilla for a very clean taste. The finish lingers well with oak, caramel, and a hint of molasses. Eddie's done the family name proud. I'm scoring Wild Turkey 81 and 89. You'll find all of my tasting notes in the free WhiskeyCast smartphone apps for iPhone, iPad, and Android. The Apple version is sponsored by the Glenrothes, and the Android version is sponsored by Benromic. They're also available at the WhiskeyCast website, along with links for the WhiskeyCast Facebook page and my Twitter feed, the calendar of events, the WhiskeyCast store, powered by Amazon.com, and a complete archive of past episodes. The address is www.whiskeycast.com, and my email address is comments@whiskeycast.com. Next time around, I'll announce the winners in our first Father's Day giveaway. Our sponsors are providing prize packages ranging from jackets and travel bags to golf gear. All you have to do to be eligible to win is be a subscriber to the WhiskeyCast email newsletter, like WhiskeyCast on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or post feedback for the show or one of the apps in the iTunes store or the Android market. WhiskeyCast is a production of Cask Strength Media, copyright 2011. And comes to you from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.